Then put your little hand in mine. There ain't no hill or mountain we can't climb.
I got you. Okay, campers, rise and shine, and welcome to the Cinema Faith Podcast for February 2016. Today is Groundhog Day. The movie is Groundhog Day, and it is our topic of discussion. I'm your host, Jonathan Butrin, and I am joined once again by my partner in crime, Mr. Tim Nelson. Tim, happy Groundhog Day.
Happy Groundhog Day there, John. I'm excited to talk about this very old film with you.
Absolutely, and I have to say, right off the bat, Tim, I adore this movie. I can't tell you how much. There's just something about this film that has always resonated with me. In fact, and this is going to be embarrassing, but I once watched Groundhog Day in true Groundhog Day fashion 3 times in a row. That is a true story. 3 times. Granted, I was very young, had a lot of time on my hands, and I was actually had a friend who was even more obsessed with movies than I was, and we just kept watching it. But that's how much this film meant to me. What's your experience with it? Do you have fond memories as well, or what is it?
So my connection to Groundhog Day, this is very weird. I have a very kind of peripheral connection. My family, like my mom and my dad and my little sister, live in the town where they filmed Groundhog Day in Illinois.
It's in Illinois.
It's in Woodstock, Illinois. It's okay. An hour and a half from where we're sitting right now.
Ha!
And they filmed most of it in the square in Woodstock, Illinois. You can go there. It looks just like it did then.
Like the cafe? Do they have that there?
The cafe's changed names, but it exists still. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, it's there.
That's awesome.
The Bell Tower, which was supposed to be, it's an opera house that they made it seem like a hotel, all this other stuff. But it's still there. They actually have a plaque where Bill Murray walks into the water when he's after he's done talking with Ned Ryerson.
Yes.
It's there. That's my, so I liked Groundhog Day before, but when my parents moved there and apparently you get a copy of Groundhog Day from people, your neighbors,
that's great.
You move there.
You think Punxsutawney would have like taken this and run with it, you know, like Scranton for The Office or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I think one of the issues, I read a little bit online about that, and actually where Groundhog, like the celebrations happen in Punxsutawney is like 2 miles out of a town. And I think they wanted the feel of being inside a town square, and you can get that
right
where my parents live. Yeah.
Gotcha. That's awesome. Now I need to throw out a little bit of a plot synopsis. I mean, there may be some people watching who have not seen this movie. And by the way, if that's you, please just stop this podcast right now and go watch Groundhog Day. You have to.
3 times.
Please, 3 times, yeah. But maybe you haven't seen it in a while and you're just like, I remember seeing this movie, but I don't remember what it's about. So real quick, Groundhog Day stars Bill Murray as Phil Connors.
Isn't that enough to like get people to watch right there?
For me, it is.
It stars Bill Murray.
And he's a weatherman who works for Channel 9 Pittsburgh. And he travels every year to Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania to cover the Groundhog Festival that they have there. And he finds himself waking up the next day after covering the festival. And it's Groundhog Day again. And then he wakes up the next day and it's the same day. And he finds himself reliving this day over and over again, where every single person is in the exact same place that they were the first time it happened, and if he goes the same way, he'll run into them at the exact same moments, and that's basically it. He's stuck in reliving this day over and over again, and he has to decide what to do from there. So that is the film. And to begin a proper conversation, I think, about Groundhog Day, you have to start with Bill Murray. So, as you may have guessed, I'm a huge Bill Murray fan. Something about his comedy just completely resonates with me. It's like he just looks funny. It's kind of like Will Ferrell, where he doesn't have to do anything. His lines could be stupid, but like I will laugh watching him because he just has a funny aura about him. And I really jive with his sarcastic sense of humor. My wife hates how sarcastic I can be, but like that I think is what jives me with him. So what about you? Do you like Bill Murray, Tim?
I like Dr. Peter Venkman.
Ghostbusters, of course.
That character, I like the Stripes character. I think the idea of that he's the smartest person in the room, and he uses those abilities to kind of slack off and buck authority. And I like that kind of, like, he's really mastered that character. And I think it almost makes people think that is who Bill Murray is. And I don't know if it is, but the idea that you could be kind of smart and you could see the absurdity in a situation and then be a cynic, but also be funny. And I think that Bill Murray has that. And this character is a little darker in some ways than some of his other characters.
Yeah. Well, when you talk about Bill Murray in real life, I actually don't, at least now, he does not appear to be that way. Bill Murray's kind of like arrived at this point in his life where he's just a legend and everyone knows who he is. You know, he's easily recognizable. And it's really funny. If you go online and you like Google Bill Murray encounters, like he's just basically spending his days walking around the country, just showing up at random places and interacting with people. Like, it's crazy. Like, there's whole websites devoted to this. There's, you know, you'll have a couple doing their anniversary photos, and he just wanders into the photo and poses with them, and he'll crash a wedding.
That fits his whole idea, right?
It works, but like that's the thing. And he's one of those like rare actors who you see him on the back of a bumper of a car, and it just makes total sense. You know, just him in a tuxedo. It's like it just says everything you need to know.
So you know how people buy things that have images of celebrities on them. So apparently he's surpassed, or he's up there with the Beatles and Elvis at this point.
Get out of
with
town.
His buying things that have his image on them.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it is. So what you're saying is like, yeah, when you see him in the back of a car, that happened. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how popular he is.
He is. This is my favorite Bill Murray story that I read online. So these guys are sitting in a Wendy's and they're just, you know, eating a burger and fries or whatever. Bill Murray walks into the Wendy's, takes a handful of fries from this guy's tray and just starts eating it. And he looks at the guy and says, "No one's going to believe you anyway." Yeah.
I love it.
That's Bill Murray.
Yeah. Yeah.
But as far as this film work goes, like, and you touched on this, I think he's really mastered this. I mean, really, if you want to simplify it, he's mastered being a jerk. He's really, really good at playing a jerk, right? And that's being a little crass about it, because you're right. There is kind of more of a rebellious sophistication to it. But especially in Groundhog Day for the first half, I mean, legitimately, this is a self-absorbed jerk.
But he's not like everything he says is pretty accurate.
Yeah, no, totally.
So he's a jerk. He is self-absorbed. But he does get the irony of the situation that he's in. I think that we all feel that way sometimes. So he gets we're going to watch this giant squirrel predict the weather again for the how many years in a row. I mean, that's the reality of that situation. And I think that there's something in us that wants to have the cynical person point out the irony in the situation.
You're right, and that's why it works, and that's why you don't hate the guy, and that's why you're laughing, because he's saying what you're thinking, but you're scared to say it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you see this in some of Bill Murray's movies too, like where he starts off as kind of a unlikable guy who's selfish, and then he becomes good, right? You almost have like bad Bill Murray turning into good Bill Murray. Scrooge is almost exactly like that, right? But I think Groundhog Day features one of like his most smoothest transitions from bad to good, if you will. Like in Scrooge, it feels like he just churns on a dime, you know, from being this horrible person to like in the last 10 minutes, all of a sudden, like a light switch flicks on and he's loves the world and everybody in it. I don't know.
So there's some people that, as far as screenplays and stories, they think that everything hinges on character development, which I'm a big fan of character development.
Yeah.
And so what you see in this film is you see character development occurring over and over and over again with that being the variable and not necessarily and the situation being exactly the same. So it basically brings out this character development that's occurring for Murray. And he goes to these stages of that character development. That's changed, and that's where and there's tension in that, and I think that there's something to that in the story that really draws us, because I think, isn't that what we want? Like, don't we want change in our lives? Don't we want to have this character development occur? I mean, you look at we can talk more about it in a little bit, but I think that that's really attractive. And I think that drives that story.
Do you think that as the transformation goes along, do you think that when you're looking at kind of the two halves of the film, where you have sort of the self-absorbed stage part and then what he becomes, that the second half is less fun than the first half? Could you make that argument? Because I get that a little twinge of that, you know, that like the first half you're kind of rollicking along on this fun ride and then it becomes a little bit less fun. But still,
I think we like the Bill Murray that says the things that we can't say.
That's it, right?
So when he's you know mocking the Groundhog Day ceremony, when he's saying they're called Hicks,
Hicks Rita, Hicks.
Yeah, Hicks Rita, yeah. I think he says the things that we might be thinking, or that we wish we were kind of quick enough to think. And there's sometimes when he's cruel, like when he makes fun of people, like in really, really kind of heartless ways.
Yeah,
that we don't like about that, but I think that's very interesting. right? Because it seems like the rest of that town is very positive, very communal, and he seems to be like this bucking all the community that is being offered to him. Like everyone else seems pretty nice and like mm-hmm. well differentiated and like happy. And then we see his character and he's not. So I think he's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's much more interesting than the person that's like so excited to say good morning to him. Like he's interesting.
Yeah.
So, and he's intelligent. So I think that there we get drawn to him. So I think that's true what you're saying.
And the interesting thing about the movie too is like, and you have to, because the movie repeats itself so many times, you have to have kind of these interesting, these almost over the top characters, but it's not, it doesn't feel too over the top. You know, so you have like the guy who first greets him in the morning, you have Ned Ryerson, of course, the highlight. And so you have all these interesting moments because they have to feel like different segments of the day. And so yeah, Ned Ryerson. Am I right? Am I right?
Am I right?
What I think is probably Bill Murray's best line when Ned Ryerson says, "What are you doing for dinner?" And he says, "Something else." do you have a favorite line or a favorite moment from it?
I have a favorite scene.
Okay.
Do you want me to talk about that already, or we want to talk about that?
Maybe we'll hold on.
We'll hold on.
All right.
I have a favorite scene, but I do. Yeah, it's hard to pick. It's an excellent movie, and I don't have a. Yeah, it's hard to pick, I'm going to be honest.
All right, no worries. You know what's like this throwaway part that I always think about too is it's kind of dumb, but like remember when he's talking on the payphone and he's talking about the satellite, right? Is it snowing in space? Because he's trying to get a line out, right? So mm-hmm. he's like, don't you have a line open that you keep for celebrities or emergencies? And he's like, I'm both. I'm a celebrity and emergency. And this old guy comes along with his shovel and smacks him accidentally over the head with it. And I like that. I don't know why that makes me smile every single time I think about it, but it's just so perfect.
Yeah.
So, but it's not only a great performance. I mean, it's really, truly just a great, well-rounded film. I mean, it's so well-constructed because you think about it, the movie could have gotten very repetitive, almost boring, because like the concept, you're going every day is the same, but at the same time, like the way that it's edited and directed is so perfect because it never feels the same, even though it obviously is the same. Like that takes a lot of talent.
So I think it's interesting because like I talked about character development, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this film is one of the first films that I think really, I mean, this is, now we're getting kind of high-minded. I know I like theology. I like a little bit of philosophy. I'm not an expert in either one or an expert on film.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of like, you know, putting my big toe in the water here.
Please.
But like one of the things that you see in this is you see like how should we live? Like that's what this film begs the question, like or asks us the question, how should we live? Like, what is the way to live? And he goes through these ethical progressions and to where he starts asking questions that as he gets more kind of ethical, he begins to ask more and more questions of the people around him. Like, well, how would I be? Like, what would you like me to be like? What's your perfect guy? Mm. I mean, that's like those are pretty heavy questions. But I think everybody, if you're a Christian or if you're not a Christian, I think ask that question, like, how should I live? And and he goes through these like real base stages where he is he's basically living for pleasure and he's living isolated. And so you see him like he's got a table of donuts.
Yeah.
And he's smoking cigarettes and he's like drinking coffee from the pot, which I relate to all those things now. No. And so he's basically kind of hedonistic in his ideas, like basically this like the most base pleasures are his ethic. And so, hey, if I'm trapped in this crappy place and I'm here for eternity, then I'm going to devote myself to the most base pleasures. I'm going to try to seduce women who are easily seducible that I don't actually love. I'm going to eat as many donuts as I can because really none of this matters. And so he starts out with that. And I think about Aristotle, I know some of the commentators on this say this is really looking at like Aristotelian ethics, and that's like a big old topic on its own. But basically, there's this idea within that ethical system that we would exchange our base pleasures for greater pleasures, so that we would know we wouldn't eat the donut. We would say there's a better pleasure out there, and we're gonna leave those base pleasures and go to something that's greater. It's like maybe French poetry might be a greater pleasure that he's never experienced until he's forced to, or playing an instrument. Or serving other people. So you see this progression, but I think what I think is brilliant in the movie, in the ethics, is that after he kind of leaves this idea of this hedonism, he goes straight to depression.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
It's almost like the stages of grief in the movie, right? It's like he's in denial about the situation.
Right.
Then he's then he embraces it. Then he is depressed, and then he accepts it. And you're right.
No. And so he kills himself in just a whole bunch of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also think that some of the best, it's not my favorite scene, but one of the scenes that's great is he's in the bar with the bowling alley bar with two townies.
Yeah.
And they're drinking, and he asks them, do you know what it's like to live the same day, the same people, and not feel like you have any consequence at all? Whatever. I can't remember his whole monologue. And they're like, yeah.
That about sums it up for me.
Right. You know the lines because you watched it more times than I have.
Yeah.
But, I think that a lot of us feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. A lot of us feel like, is our life even consequential? Does it matter? Are we taking any joy at all from life at all? And so you can see these guys are basically... Well, I'm just going to numb out to try to feel some joy, because I can't feel joy in life.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's who we like. So he congregates with these guys, and they have some adventures. Well, if you haven't seen it, watch it.
So the movie's directed by Harold Ramis. He directed Ghostbusters, of course, and he stars in the movie as well. Did you see him in there? Mm-hmm. He's the doctor. Very brief, but here's something you might not know, or probably do, but did you know that Harold Ramis and Bill Murray had a huge falling out over this movie?
I just found that out, because I was reading some stuff for today, and I just found that out.
And it's pretty crazy, because the argument was over the tone of the film. So Bill Murray was wanting the movie to be more philosophical, more about, you know, deeper things, and Harold Ramis just wanted to make a comedy. And what's so ironic about that is, like, the movie is such a perfect blend of those two things, and it's like they almost met in the middle out of sheer just creative tension, you know? Because it feels like that. It's just that's what's so great is, like, the movie encompasses so many genres. I mean, it's romantic, it's funny, it's serious, and yet it bobs and weaves it's not like there's segments of it. It's just simultaneously is all those things. Love that.
We were talking earlier before we did the podcast, I'm kind of glad that Ramis went with more of the comedic tone. I really do. Mm-hmm. Because it makes this film accessible to people.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were talking about Terrence Malick before. Yes. And it's like, geez, I gotta know about transcendentalism and existent. I have to know 19th and 20th century philosophy to begin to watch a Terrence Malick show, and then I have to know all about art, and so it becomes this exercise in just hyper intellectualism. And I don't feel that way about Groundhog Day, but I feel like a normal viewer who thinks this is going to be a funny show can enter into some of these deep ethical thoughts, mm-hmm, and character development, and can put themselves in the place of Murray.
You're going to deep places like Malick, but it's so accessible. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about the time loop scenario. So like we said, Phil kind of goes through these stages where he's really happy about, at first he doesn't even believe it's happening. Then he's really excited about it, and he becomes hedonistic and does all these crazy things. And then he has his eye on this producer, Rita, who's played by Andie MacDowell in the movie. And she's kind of like this... she's really like this elevated, the movie really elevates her. It's almost like, I might be imagining this, but it's almost like they put a glow on her face. Like, that's just how she feels throughout the film, you know? And so he goes after her and tries to create this perfect day that will culminate in them hooking up at the end of it. And he can't do it. No matter how many times he tries, he probably, for all we know, tries for years to create, mm-hmm, this perfect day. She, at the end of it, it never works out. So he goes through that, then he gets super depressed and he starts killing himself, and that doesn't work, and so he ends up killing himself in about every way you can. And then finally at the end of it, he embraces it and truly tries to change and become a better person. So that's how Phil Connors handles his time loop. Tim, I'm very curious. You had to know this was coming. Put yourself in Phil's shoes, all right? So the same scenario, you're in Punxsutawney and you were waking up on Groundhog Day, same thing. How would you spend your days?
So I think that's it's a point. Like, they really do point out how I would probably start out, which is, you know, I spend some of my days at, you know, like Phil in the donuts, like in real life. Okay. So I think we have days like that, right? Mm-hmm. We have days where what is the point of this day? It's drudgery. I'm going to work. And I think we have days like that. And I think we have these depression days. Like, those are people, right?
Hmm.
And I think we have, like, I don't see the end of this. This is pointless. What is the point of existence? I mean, he asks, that's the question that this kind of, like, yeah, I can eat donuts and, like, drink whiskey until whenever, but if I'm
really
honest. So you're
saying Groundhog Day isn't as fantastical as it might seem. Groundhog Day is our day.
I think it's, I just think it's real life. That's right. Yeah. But I also think that in that, you do have moral development.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is funny because as Christians, like, I think a lot of us were raised to have duty ethics, like deontological ethics, which would be the Bible says this, so do this,
mm-hmm.
which is nothing close to like anything that you see in Groundhog Day at all. There's no prohibition of anything. Yet you look at a full life at the end of the movie, he has a day that's like a day. That's basically a perfect day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that asks us like, what does it look like to live in this kind of daily way?
Mm-hmm.
As Christians, and not just look at our ethics as prohibition.
Yeah.
I also think it's interesting as he's achieving that moral development, this is where it gets into my favorite scene. He starts learning the piano.
Yeah.
And he begins, I think it's a Rachmaninoff piece that he's learning. And he's really fumbling along. He's playing notes at the wrong time. His timing is off, all this other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Aristotle compares moral development to like a piece of music, is you have to play the right note at the right time in comparison to the other notes. And as Christians, we tend to look at it as like, do this, this is wrong, and this is right. And with Aristotle, it's like, no, this is the right thing at the right time. And so music becomes like more for him, like a metaphor for ethics. And it's really interesting. This is where my favorite scene comes in. I had to watch this many times before I saw this, but I just wept when I saw it. So he's beginning, as he plays, he gets the piece more right and more right and more right as he's going. And they play it in the background
yeah.
and he's fumbling. And then he wants to save this guy's life and he plays it perfectly. So it's like a bum in the alley and he's trying to save his life and he plays the piece like with like perfection. It's like he reached the ethical pinnacle of where he was supposed to be when he played that piece of music. Right. So it's like, you see that. I didn't see that for a long time. I just wept when I saw it, 'cause I was like, that's so beautiful. And as we're looking at that film, I mean, that's heavy stuff.
Yeah.
Malik doesn't get there for me. Okay. Maybe I'm just
even in Tree of Life.
Wow. Tree of Life, it's a good movie. It's visually stunning. But like, I relate to that, which is sometimes we play that music real sloppy and it's messed up. And sometimes we don't even want to play. But I think that you see as he becomes more, less self-centered, more giving to other people, he looks at the point of that one day that he gets over and over again as to bring life to others. Then he begins to play that music correctly. And then we begin to see what it looks like to be fully human.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so beautiful. I didn't realize that was him playing in the background of that. Wow. There's a proverb that says, like, a kind man benefits himself, but a cruel man hurts himself. You know, that's interesting because the movie kind of, like you're saying, it brings up the kind of the life-giving life versus the, you know, self-absorbed life. And it's just contrasting them in a very non-heavy-handed way and saying, you know, which one is the way of life, really, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. One thing I would try to do if it was me is just get out of Punxsutawney. Like, I mean, I know there's a blizzard, but like, if there's not a blizzard during the whole day, like, if you wake up in the morning, you got to be able to catch a flight to London. I mean, I realize you're spending a lot of your day traveling, but you can at least enjoy some of the world. That's one thing I would try to do. I don't know.
So I think there is this theme of escapism. Like, that's the first thing he wants, is he's caught in this dilemma and he wants to get out. He's like, let's drive, let's call, let's get out of this horrible, this horrible place that is, like, it's kind of like his own hell, kind of, because he wants to get into a bigger market. He's leaving his station.
Right.
He wants to become kind of really invest in his own career.
Uh-huh.
And he's very self-absorbed in that way.
Yeah.
So he even announces to, like, the producer and to the cameraman that he's leaving.
Uh-huh.
Which is just like, what a jerk, right? And he does that. But, you know, I think there is something to be said. And I think it's drawn on I know that Andy McDowell character quotes a Sir Walter Scott poem. Is that right? And he makes the Willard Scott joke.
Yep.
And I think the idea is, and I read a little background, I don't know this really well, but it's all about having like a place. That's the whole background. It's, I think it's some crazy thing about like, you know, Scottish clan warfare is like the background of this poem, which is really weird. But it comes into, it says, "This is my own, my native land, whose heart hath never within him burned. As home his footsteps he hath turned from wandering on a foreign strand. If such there breathe, go mark him well, for he for him no menstrual raptures swell. High though his titles, proud though his name, boundless his wealth as wish can claim. Despite those titles, power and pelf, the wretch concentrated all in self, living shall forfeit fair renown, and doubly dying shall go down to the vile dust from whence he sprung, unwept, unhonored, unsung."
Yeah.
And I think place is community. And so he was looking for himself. So he's like, how do I get into a bigger market? But really what he needed was community. And there's references to small town folks. Oh, I love small town folks.
Yeah.
And it's like while he's doing the self-advancement, he never actually develops real relationships. And I think that that's another one of those things that goes through there. I also think it's interesting that his job is to tell the future, but he has none.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that he is the equivalent of the groundhog. So he's like he's basically inconsequential in the scope of human history, a weatherman is. No offense to all the weathermen out there.
Oh boy.
But what your value is you tell what the next day's weather is. That's like your value.
He doesn't have the next day.
And he doesn't have the next day. So that's, he loses vocation, and that for him is salvation, which is kind of cool. A lot of Asian words there, but
here's something. I was wondering, so you know how he kind of goes through this hedonistic period where he's, you know, doing all these awful things. And I think the movie's fairly pretty tame with that. Let's be honest. I mean, it's a PG movie, right? Like that's what I wonder, right? So you're in a situation where basically nothing you do matters, where, you know, everything's going to be reset at the next day. So how far does the average human go? That's my question. You know what I'm saying? Like we like to pretend that we're extremely good people and we're inherently, you know, going to do the right thing. But I mean, really, let's be honest, a lot of that goodness is because there are rules in place and we understand that consequences mean jail time and et cetera, et cetera. So you're in this fantasy land where basically you can do anything. How far do most people take it?
Well, I think as far as he goes, which is like where you find that it's utterly meaningless. I mean, I think like even if you talk to any addict, because I think that's where that would lead eventually, is
right.
just addiction because you're numbing out. If you talk to any addict, you'd say, like, are they happy? No, absolutely not. Are they numb? Yeah, sometimes. And then they want to get numb because they're going to feel unhappy if they're not numb. And I think he gets to the point of suicide. So yeah, I think that's right. Very realistic.
Right. And that's where it ultimately lead. But I'm saying he would ultimately, you would think that the average human would go to darker places than we see in the film.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Than drinking or chugging coffee.
Yeah,
but I think there is, and I think now even more so than maybe when the movie was made. I mean, I think about how you can clear, you know, you can clear your history on your computer pretty quick, right?
Right.
And so I think that's true. I think there's some darkness. I was thinking about, they didn't have him have a family, which is, I think, really helpful. Because then he didn't have a set group of people that he like depended on him. But I think, you know, looking at that from my own viewpoint, it's like, I think that was probably, it would be interesting to see a version of that with a family, but it kind of eliminated variables. I think we could go dark. I think we can all go very dark.
I just know the tendencies inside of me as it is, you know, with having rules in place, with being accountable to my wife, with my family, and just the things that I fight against. And I'm just scared of what, you know, the places I would go. Now, I would think, too, that I would, I would still believe that there is a God of this universe that I'm accountable to. And I would still believe that. I think even if I was in this kind of scenario, and I guess I would always wonder at what point would the switch flip back, you know, like you do something absolutely horrible and then it's like, oh, it's tomorrow and I'm in jail and that's that.
So, but like, I think in the film, it would be like this great depression of suicide. Cause like, I think he realized like when you start committing suicide over and over again, I mean, that's pretty brave if you're going to wake up the next day.
Well, you think about that. Like, yeah, it's like just waking up and like, and taking a toaster and putting, it's like, yeah, you have to be at a pretty dark place for that.
But I think that is kind of, I think that is like where we all eventually go in that, because there's like guilt and shame and like, what's the point?
Yep.
And they don't get into Murray's head that much, mm-hmm. you know, they don't. But I do think that there are a lot of us feel like we're living the same day over and over again. And I think we do feel captive and bound to those things. And I think the Christian message is not so much don't do these things, or if we don't have boundaries in these things, then they'll take us captive. I think the Christian message is more like, and this is weird, I'm like more like Aristotle, is saying, how do we live?
Yeah.
And is there a way to live that will bring us real joy and not just numb us out or get us a high?
Right. Well, it goes just back to that God isn't this cosmic rule maker in the sky. He's saying this is the way to live, and these things will destroy you. And they will, you know, they will put a black cloud between you and me, which ruins our relationship, and that thus takes away everything we were designed to be, right? That's what it's all about.
Yeah. With the character... It is interesting because I think that there's a lot of theologians that want to put Christian value on this, but it's actually probably more Buddhist.
Okay.
Well,
like being reincarnated every day. And
there is that. There's elements of the kind of like you're reincarnated. But I think the other elements of it are, is like, what are these values that we, what is humanity? Like, what is to be human? And I think to be a hedonistic is not human.
Right, right.
But to do things, like to basically have, your character change over a long period of time in small increments is very human. So when you see him like take up an instrument or learn French, that takes a little bit of effort over a long period of time. And I think that is the message that we see in that, is to learn how to play that beautiful piece of piano. It took him day after day after day after day after day after day, delayed gratification, to learn how to play that piece of music. But then as he appreciates it more and more, he's actually enjoying it. He's not just doing it to get the girl anymore.
Exactly. Well, that's what the switch is. When you see the switch from him trying to get Andy McDowell in the beginning, it's all about him. It's all about what he can get out of it. And then later, he's doing it because I think he's realizing that this is giving him joy. It is giving him legitimate life. That's the difference. Right. So, Tim, we already talked about you. You kind of talked about your what you see as the principal theme of Groundhog Day. Is it fair to say it's basically sanctification? Is that one of the areas you see truth colliding here?
I don't know if sanctification, I think maybe that would be the Christian word for it.
Yeah.
But I would say like personal development or character development or probably ethical development. So that knowing, I think the idea of like trading, exchanging lesser desires for greater ones and seeing ethical, like creating a system of ethics where you value some things more than others and you're willing to trade momentary pleasure for something that is more lasting. So I think that that's definitely a theme within there. I think they can fit in multiple religious and non-religious traditions.
Sure.
Now, as far as like, how does Christianity deal with that? I think that far too often we look at everything as like it's like the bad and the good categories. And we don't look at what is God creating? How do we deeply, meaningfully have community? Because I think that was key to the ethic, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Like that's where he learned the ethic. It wasn't from just like some kind of like abstract morality out there. It was from a community of people who seemed like they actually cared about him. And he kind of needed that community to learn how to care for them.
And getting to know them. I mean, he really, you know, when he goes around the coffee shop and he's like reciting everybody's story, I mean, he's spent time getting to know these people.
Right.
Clearly.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I know that there's they interviewed Harold Ramis for some of this, and they're like, well, how many years was he there?
Right.
What did you hear?
I heard that the official position was at least 30, and then it's someone said in the original script it said 10,000 years. That's what the original.
That's what it actually said.
Yeah, that's what it said.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
But I think they took the official position of 30 years.
But that's a lifetime, like 30 years of an adult life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's from like Bill Murray's probably 40, right? In that role, or 45 or whatever.
Yeah.
That's his life. So it took him his life to like kind of become morally developed and live one day to where it was considered like that was a good day. And I think that's encouraging in some kind of weird way.
It is. Yeah. Another thing that struck me too, on my most recent viewing was how, like, Phil's attempts that you're talking about, especially in terms of winning Rita, kind of are like how we try to perform for God. You know, like I was thinking about, especially when he's at the beginning, when he's all about getting Rita, and he just is trying to line up all these elements. If I just do this, then she'll like me, and then it will all click. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
And I feel like, you know, he probably spends all these years doing this thing over and over again, and he's doing it out of selfishness. But then, like, Rita calls him on it, and it's like, did you call up my friends and find out what I like and don't like? Is this what love is for you, right? And we think that, I think a little bit too, we fall into that trap. If I do my devotions in the morning, know what I'm saying?
That's a good point you're making.
So it's kind of this performance mentality, which never leads to life, and it isn't actually what God wants from us. So I think just with our spiritual walk, there's no power if we're on this quest to constantly get something from God, whether that's favor, whether that's love, like reading your Bible more, etc. And so how does Phil finally get Rita? That's the question. It's not by focusing on getting something from her. Instead, it's like by emulating her. Right, and I think that's what Phil is because he even says that point blank at some point. I forget the line, but he says, like basically pointing out that I want to be like you because you're like this perfect person, basically in his mind. And so Rita's up on this pedestal, and that's where the heart change comes from. Is kind of like modeling his life after hers, and it ultimately comes from love.
Yeah,
and we know that, like, you know, in almost every Hollywood film, love is the ultimate ideal, and human love is basically as far as it goes. But as Christians, we know that they're half right. That love is what ultimately changes us, and what ultimately changes Phil. But it's a perfect love because human love will eventually let you down. Rita will eventually let Phil down, right? Mm-hmm. But the perfect love that we have through emulating Christ is what brings change in us. And there's a psalm that I was reminded of. It's Psalm 131:2. It says, I've calmed and quieted myself. I'm like a weaned child with its mother, like a weaned child. I'm content.
My soul within me, yeah.
And so Phil, at the end of the movie, when he's just with Rita laying on that bed, you know, and he's just saying, he's basically like, what can I do for you today? And I have enough right now. You know, it's no longer about getting something. It's no longer about winning Rita's favor. It's just, he's happy to spend any moment that he can with her. And what a beautiful picture of how our relationship with God should look like.
I love that psalm because in the beginning it says, I've not concerned myself with things too great for me.
Yes.
And the idea being like, I think that's what Phil had done.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, I'm going to get what I need to get, and I'm going to do whatever it takes to get that.
Yeah.
And I don't care about people, and I'm not gonna let these schmucks hold me down, my goofy cameraman or my kind of idealistic producer. I'm gonna get what I can, and I'm gonna get it.
Yeah.
And I think the idea is like he's gonna impress his image onto the world. And I find like what happens in the film, and I think that we see this in our Christian walk too, is that no, actually there's an image that's gonna get impressed on us.
Yes.
And that's like so different. That happens, right? Because you get Andy's image gets impressed upon him.
Yeah, exactly.
And not just hers, but the image of the whole community, which I kind of think is beautiful. But it's not like what I was taught in church.
No, it
that
isn't.
That is not it.
Why is that?
Yeah.
So I think that's all the time we got for today, but you know, the film's Groundhog Day, and if you're listening to this on Groundhog Day, you still have time to participate in watching this movie, so please do, because you know, even if it's not Groundhog Day, it's worth another look.
You could pretend it's Groundhog Day. For Phil, it might still be.
It's just such a rewatchable film. It's so fun, and then there's these hidden depths that we were able to explore. So it's classic. There's no question. And you know, I think proof of that is just how many times the premise has been regurgitated throughout the years. You know, most recently, Tom Cruise's movie. What was that? The sci-fi movie, Edge of Tomorrow.
Oh yeah,
yes, which I thought was a fantastic movie.
It was all right. I haven't like watched. I've watched it once.
Okay,
I always say this to folks. I'm not really observant, so it takes me a while to really appreciate a film.
Sure. But yeah. It was the same premise as that. He's reliving the same day, except it takes place in the future with aliens and the military. So it's like, but it still touches on some of the same themes there. And Tim, also, I want you to know that if you ever find yourself in Groundhog Day scenario, track me down, and we'll figure it out.
You'll believe me, right?
We'll believe
you. And we'll, like, we won't waste any time.
No, no, we'll go right to it.
We'll get the donuts right away.
That's what friends are for.
Are you going to ask me about my character development at that point?
Probably.
And I'll be like, I told you yesterday, but you just don't remember.
Exactly. Cool. Oh, so great talking with you, Tim. And as always, keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next time.